Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to CAF Chats. I am Major Matt Fine, one of the new faculty members here in ADC coming on board this summer. And today I am joined by
Major Darren Hubbard. I am also a new face, I guess, voice to this podcast. I am an adjunct professor with the 13th LOD coming on to help Major Fine and the rest of the team out.
We also have a special guest with us today, Jose Cuba, a 1L summer intern. Jose is a rising 2L at Washington and Lee Law School. He is spending the last 10 weeks or coming up there on with the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. How have you been enjoying the summer so far, Jose?
Oh, it's been really, really awesome. So it's been such a cool experience. I think like specifically coming into the schoolhouse and getting to learn from all of you guys and all the different departments has just been amazing.
Obviously, your time in ADC has been your favorite experience, but any other standout memories?
I really liked the leadership classes. I think they were led by Colonel Rojas, I think it was the name. But it was so good. It's a very unique experience.
And should we be looking forward to your application to the Army JAG Corps here shortly?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah, no,
so that's a yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, very clear.
Cross examination. I heard a yes.
Yeah, that's what I heard too, for the record.
Perfect.
Okay, so today on this episode, we're going to be discussing the CAF decision in United States versus Sergeant First Class Michael Malone. That's case number 25-0140. It's coming out of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. Jose, why don't you get us started with the facts on the case, and then we're going to kind of move to analysis after that.
Yeah, of course. So Sergeant First Class Malone was charged with several offenses, to include three specifications of domestic violence in violation of Article 128B UCMJ. Sergeant First Class Malone pled guilty to domestic violence specifications and two specifications of disobeying a superior commissioned officer in exchange for dismissal of additional charges, including aggravated assault and maiming. The charges all arise from allegations that he used physical violence on his girlfriend during an argument. And the facts are as follows. On the evening of November 30th, 2022, an argument erupted between Sergeant First Class Malone and his girlfriend. When the victim attempted to call 911, Sergeant First Class Malone struck her in the face while they were in the master bedroom. The assault continued as the confrontation moved into the bathroom, where he repeatedly punched her in the face, arms, shoulders, abdomen, and leg. He then threw the victim to the ground, causing her to suffer a broken right clavicle. During the Providence inquiry, Sergeant First Class Malone acknowledged that the conduct underlying the three domestic violence specifications arose from the same event or transaction. This was made clear when the judge talked about it, saying that this same date, location, and victim, and the specifications 1 and 3 recited the exact same facts, striking the victim's face with appellant's hand. Consistent with his plea agreement, the military judge sends him to reduction to the grade of E3, a bad conduct discharge, and a total confinement of 30 months. Sergeant First Class Malone later appealed to the United States Army Court of Criminal Appeals, ACCA, on the grounds that his specifications were multiplicious. In military law, multiplicity of charges refers to a situation where an accused service member is charged with two or more specifications that punish the exact same offense, which is a violation of the constitutional protections against double jeopardy. ACCA initially held that Sergeant First Class Malone waived multiplicity issue, but later, upon an en banc reconsideration, concluded that there was no waiver and found the specifications multiplicious. The acting TJAG of the Army certified two issues for review by the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, CAF. First, whether the Army Court erred in finding that the appellee affirmatively waived the multiplicity issues by failing to raise it at trial. Second, whether the domestic violence specifications were facially duplicative when the underlying violent offenses were assault consummated by battery and aggravated assault. The primary source of controversy in this case comes from Sergeant Malone's arraignment, where the following was said on the record. The military judge said, "Appellee, how do you plea? Before receiving your plea, I advise you that any motions to dismiss or to grant other appropriate relief should be made at this time. Your defense counsel will speak for you. The defense counsel replied, Your Honor, the defense has no motions. Ultimately, Chief Judge Olson, in a 4-1 decision for the CAF, ruled that Sarnford's class Malone did in fact waive multiplicity.
Jose, thank you for that wonderful overview and summary. One thing that I will add, just to tee up potentially the risk of this being considered a largely academic exercise, is that upon en banc review, the ACCA ultimately merged those three specifications you were talking about into one super spec, but nonetheless affirmed the original sentence. So when this issue went up to the CAF, it was really the questions that you raised that TJAG had certified. I think that you hit the nail on the head, right? That the key issue, it really centers on those five words, the defense has no motions. But there's an underlying issue as well in this, which is what is the unit of prosecution in Article 128 Bravo cases? And those are sort of the two ways that we'll look at this case, is the issue of waiver and the waiver analysis as it relates to multiplicity, as well as the defense has no motions. I think a few legal baselines to start with for those of us, like perhaps myself, that don't live in appellate land, are some reminders that RCM 907 Bravo 3 Bravo explicitly states that multiplicity serves as a proper ground for dismissal of specifications. And that importantly, and as the CAF notes in its opinion, the rule RCM 910 J.
Juliet, you got it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. These letters are hard. There's so many of them. Was amended, but only after this case was initially tried. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it now reads that it, except in conditional pleas, a plea of guilty that results in a finding of guilty waives any objection, whether or not previously raised, as to the factual issue of guilt of the offenses to which the plea has made, and any non-jurisdictional defect as to the offenses to which the plea was made that occurred prior to the plea. So I think it's worth noting that the RCM has changed after this case, arguably in a way that makes sort of this waiver issue or risk of waiver more clear. The CAF reviews the issue of waiver de novo, and the ACCA and the dissenting opinion in the CAF opinion believe that ultimately appellee forfeited versus waived multiplicity. And so that's really the tension in the CAF's opinion, is between waiver and forfeiture.
Right.
So what is waiver, right? Waiver is a intentional relinquishment or an abandonment of a known right, or it occurs by operation of law. And importantly, certainly for the dissenting opinion, is that a waiver extinguishes an issue and therefore cannot be reviewed on appeal. Certainly why it matters whether for Sarn First Class Malone or those who follow. But it's also worth remembering that an unconditional guilty plea will ordinarily, especially after that change we discussed to RCM 910 Juliet, will ordinarily waive all defects which are neither jurisdictional nor a deprivation of the due process of law. Unconditional guilty pleas thus waive multiplicity issues, except when multiplicity involves specifications that are facially duplicative, i.e. factually the same, which, as Jose talked about, was largely the issue in Malone, and certainly the majority's opinion was that it was obvious to everyone, although no one ever once said it.
Out loud, right.
Right, just their internal thoughts, that the three specifications were facially or factually the same.
Multiplicious, duplicative, basically.
Correct. Now, an express waiver or voluntary consent can still foreclose the issue of a facially duplicative multiplicity issue on appeal. And again, why then those five words, the defense has no motions, become so important, is it really boils down to a question of whether those five words constituted an express waiver. The CAF reminds us in Malone that there are no magic words required to establish waiver, although maybe it sure feels like sometimes there are certain words that feel more magical than others. So as Jose said, right, ultimately the CAF concluded that the statement by defense counsel of no motions constituted affirmative action expressly waiving multiplicity. Baked into that conclusion is really two subdeterminations or subparts. One, that the defense counsel can waive multiplicity on behalf of their client. And two, that there was an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right. The dissent in Malone really tees up what I believe to be the likely concern from the field, which is that really this second premise, that there was an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right in uttering those five words, really raises the issue of whether we're talking about waiver or forfeiture. The concern raised in the dissent and likely held by many in the field is that the majority relied, at least in part, on the fact that an ineffective assistance of counsel claim was not raised by Sergeant First Class Malone. The dissent likely captures the concern from the field that the logical conclusion of the majority's reliance in this reasoning is that all forfeiture issues that could be remedied on appeal become intentional waiver unless there is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on appeal. That is, sometimes counsel simply make mistakes not rising to the level of so serious as to trigger a concern of IAC, but nonetheless are mistakes made and they warrant appellate review. But the concern by the dissent is that those mistakes would ordinarily have been reviewed through a forfeiture analysis and plain error review, but based on the majority's reasoning, absent an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, if it was a waivable issue, it has now been waived. So I think that tease up at least the first concern and hopefully a little bit of background as to this first issue of whether those words in fact waived the multiplicity issue. I know we have some varying thoughts on whether those words were magical words or not, but Major Hubbard, what are your thoughts?
So I guess my first thought is this. The defense has no motions. You know, giving that defense attorney the benefit of the doubt that they had considered a multiplicity motion, and reading through the transcript here, it's my opinion at least that the military judge certainly teed that up for everyone with the language that she was using during the Providence inquiry. I think maybe both of the lawyers on a charitable reading of this case knew that the multiplicity could have been an issue. Nobody said it out loud. But what's concerning to me is that there's nothing in the record at all that the defendant himself made a knowing and intentional relinquishment of that claim. And because that claim, a multiplicity motion, is based on double jeopardy, My concern is that is a constitutional right held by the defendant. We can kind of argue about whether that's closely held, whether that's a fundamental right. But it's a right held by the defendant, and there's nothing in the record at all that suggests that the defendant was aware of that right or that he gave it up. And so I'm concerned a little with the CAF's reasoning that a competent defense attorney would have explained that to the defendant, and therefore we can make an inference that he knowingly and intelligently waived or relinquished the right to make that motion. I guess on my read, we should have a bit of a forcing function at the trial court level to make that clear for the record.
Certainly there seems to be a concern to conclude as the CAF does, or at least the majority does, that obviously everybody was tracking this issue that no one talked about.
Right.
And this notion that competent counsel, the military judge, the accused, everyone was aware of this because it was so facially obvious, and it was so facially obvious that it didn't even warrant a mention. That may be true. And whether that is the belief held among those practicing out in the field, I can't speak to, but I suspect many have read the Malone opinion or will read the Malone opinion and reflect on their own experiences and interactions with clients and wonder whether some of these explicit conversations occurred or whether it was the more generalized discussion of, hey, you're going to give up certain things for the benefit of the deal. I think the question that still remains open, at least for the practitioner out in the field, is at what level of depth do you go through those issues? Certainly a strong presumption would be constitutionally grounded waivers are important, and they probably warrant some focus like those in the area of double jeopardy. Some of that gets to that second issue, which we will talk about, of the unit of prosecution, because the obviousness of it in some ways depends on how one assesses the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo offenses. But Jose, since you have perhaps the freshest set of perspective and haven't been jaded perhaps by some of the trenches, did you have a reaction or an opinion when you read the statement by defense counsel as to what that meant, that the defense has no motions? Do you read that and believe that is an affirmative relinquishment of a known right or something else?
I think I did. I guess in my head, I thought that he would have explained everything to his client. And I think you guys bring up a good question of how in-depth did he actually go into explaining, you know, double jeopardy and what he was actually giving up. I don't know.
Yeah, hard fair. Thing. None of us know. And that's my problem with the opinion, Major Fine. Yeah. I guess my thought is this. Like in the colloquy prior to accepting a plea of guilty, the military judge does talk through fundamental rights with an accused. You know, you have the right to call witnesses on your behalf. You have the right to have your counsel cross-examine those witnesses. You have the right to a panel. You have the right to all of these fundamental rights under our Constitution that are explicitly mentioned. And I think, you know, were this a case where we're not talking about double jeopardy, but some other motion that could have been made on the defendant's behalf, on the accused's behalf, I think I might be more in the camp of everyone probably knew it. We can make that inference, and that inference is okay. I just think when we're touching constitutional rights like double jeopardy, we should explicitly say that. And I think the CAF kind of missed an opportunity here to direct our practitioners to do that.
I think to address that concern, there's probably two large buckets of approaches to it. One is you place it on the military judge to engage in that colloquy with the accused, much like, as you were saying, that they're giving up the right to a trial by the fact finder, the right to confront witnesses, form selection, those sorts of things that they do explicitly go over, that double jeopardy may well just fall in that bucket of really important constitutional rights that are warrant an explicit discussion with a military judge. Or the alternative is, I think, what the majority in Malone held, which is we're going to presume competent counsel, and competent counsel will have engaged in this discussion about really important constitutional rights with their client. And because we can presume that, absent a showing of ineffective assistance of counsel or a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, we will assume that counsel competently and diligently advised their client. I think to both your gentlemen's point that we don't know what their discussion was. One way to address what did they discuss would have been through that mechanism of ineffective assistance of counsel. The flip side of that, of course, is obviously the fear by any of us who have practiced, I know Major Hubbard and I both spent time in the trial defense service, is that this is just going to open the floodgates. And I right. think that's what the dissent alludes mm-hmm. to, that almost every motion now or every appeal will come with some sort of an IAC complaint in order to ensure that there's not an issue of waiver to these issues. And whether that's good for the system is probably not, but right. what the flip side of it is the less legal and more practical reality, which is it's a guilty plea. And in a guilty plea, the accused gives up all sorts of things for the benefit of the deal. Whether and at what depth the analysis needs to be, what did you give up for this good deal, is probably an unresolved and open question in some senses. But if we start with the premise that the parties were in the best position to make their negotiations at the time that they made them, how that colors the lenses through which we then review on appeal an issue that had never been previously raised outside of the multiplicity issue, I think that's a more sort of fundamental, what is the role of the court in reviewing guilty pleas and which constitutional concerns do we have when reviewing a guilty plea that we may have differently in a contested court martial.
That's right. And to your point about the ineffective assistance of counsel, Major Fine, the concern, I think, from the dissent is if it is a factor on whether or not the accused has waived a claim, if it's a factor that they're not bringing an IAC appeal, then, you know, we're going to get IAC appeals. They almost have, they're incentivized. They almost have to be baked into every appeal now. And the wave that you're talking about, I think that that is, I think that's almost inevitable after Malone, that there will be no appeals without an IAC claim if that claim is essentially going to be held against the accused making the appeal. So I think that that's, I don't know, do you concur? I think that's coming.
I do. I think almost inevitably, at least in the near term, there will be an uptick until more guidance comes. And so certainly if I was a practitioner right now in the field, I would be reevaluating how I memorialize for my own records, my conversations with my client, and sort of ensuring that whatever my standard process is and my standard checklist of the things that I discuss with my client, that I do that the same each and every time, and that I cover those key issues such as multiplicity in that conversation. I know certainly there's that practice, and their reasonable minds seem to continue to differ on this issue of the waive all waivable motions, magic language that's not magic, in plea agreements. And I know the concern sometimes among defense counsel with those clauses is if the military judge then inquires of counsel or the accused, well, what motions did you consider and then not file for the benefit of this agreement, is you're almost placed in an awkward position as a defense counsel if you have to divulge some amount of your communications with your client. Sure. And you're also potentially teeing up your own ineffective assistance of counsel claim if you list some important motions but not all of the
this
really
is your
important
IAC motion. Test
that, right,
pass your IAC test right now,
right? And so, you know, the world, according to me, I rather keep those communications between myself and my client than try to use magic language that's sometimes magic and sometimes not, and just have a really good response ready that stays between me and my client and then potentially their appellate counsel as to what we indeed did go over. I don't know that that's the right answer, but that would be my near-term solution until more guidance comes.
Throw the waive all waivable motions into the plea agreement. I think that's fair. I think that that certainly simplifies things, and I think that the CAF's holding with regard to whether or not waiver took place in Malone and how waiver takes place going forward, I think it's simple, right? That's, I think that we know now that if you say you don't have any motions, you waive a bunch of stuff. The RCM have been changed, and we have a presumption if there's no IAC, you're going to have waived. I think simplicity is the benefit of this. I think my concern and the pushback from the dissent is, you know, simplicity may not be the goal when we're talking about constitutional rights. And so I kind of see both sides of that coin.
I think that's very fair. And I think that it really does boil down to sort of how do we review and assess guilty pleas and sort of what level of not scrutiny in the maybe legal sense, but in the more practical sense, how much scrutiny do we give a bargain for agreement among the parties absent certain constitutional concerns? And then what makes that list of those constitutional concerns, I guess, multiplicity when it's obvious on its face,
right?
Maybe among them, but exactly what means, you know, what is obvious on its face, reasonable minds may differ to an extent. I think that leads us to sort of this completely unresolved issue from Malone, which is what is the unit of prosecution for Article 128 Bravo offense? As Jose said at the beginning, these three specifications involved the same victim, same time and the same place, and during the Providence inquiry with the accused became clear that it was part of the same transaction, sort of that language that Major Hubbard was talking about that seemed to suggest an awareness of multiplicity and concerns by the military judge, but that it was a continuous series of events that just sort of progressed through this violent altercation. The CAF does not reach that issue in Malone. And in a case released just the beginning of this month on the 1st of July, in Ford, the court, the CAF again, this time in a unanimous opinion, stands by its Malone reasoning that this, in the facts of that case, the issue was waived as to multiplicity, but explicitly acknowledges that the unit of prosecution when it comes to Article 128 Bravo offenses is unresolved and unclear.
Right. Correct.
Which poses its own set of problems for practitioners in the field. So if we could transition to that discussion, both as it relates to Malone and Ford, as to the challenge now before us for unit of prosecution. So in Ford, just to set the groundwork a little bit for how the CAF explicitly acknowledges the uncertainty around the unit of prosecution, once again, reviewing a guilty plea. And here there was a slightly different, but seemingly importantly different colloquy between the military judge and the accused. Essentially, there had been a motion that was filed that was still to be litigated as part of the guilty plea. And the military judge engaged in a colloquy with the accused that motion was the only motion before the court, and that effectively by entering into a guilty plea, he is waiving most or many of all other motions. That colloquy seemed to satisfy all of those on the CAF. But what the CAF then acknowledges after sort of applying the Malone rationale to the specific issues in Ford, just before the conclusion of their opinion, they note that they agree that the law is indeed unsettled about the unit of prosecution under Article 128 Bravo. But because they found waiver, they do not reach that issue.
Once again.
But stay tuned, friends, because there remain pending cases, Reed and Askins, that again raise this issue of unit of prosecution, where the CAF may, we'll see, have to address this question in those two opinions. But to the larger concern about the unit of prosecution, did you have a reaction, Major Hubbard, to this confusion?
The confusion remains, right? Especially for these 128 Bravo cases where we're talking about a course of conduct, same predicated on essentially the same transaction. You know, I think anybody that's been in the military for any amount of time at all, we've seen specifications that are kind of super specs that are punch, kick, drag, one specification versus, you know, laid out in different specifications. Especially when it's a separate specification in which there is an aggravator, you know, choking or strangling, something like that. So I guess we are kind of back pre-ACCA Malone, because the ACCA did, in fact, try to set this straight for us, and that was that issue that they took a swing at was not taken up by the CAF. So I guess my initial reaction is I'm just as confused post-Malone as I was pre-Malone.
Not the artist. Right. I think a challenge that may exist here in the interim before we get rulings on Reed and Askins is because the CAF found waiver in Malone, the question as to what persuasive authority, if any, does the ACCA's opinion in Malone as to the unit of prosecution hold for military judges and practitioners in the field, since that issue wasn't really addressed but has been now acknowledged and forwarded by the CAF as an unsettled area. There is that baseline dilemma for the government as to how to charge it and for the defense as to when and whether to raise the multiplicity concerns. Obviously, if you're the defense, you should always raise a multiplicity concern when you have the evidence to support it or the charge sheet tees that up. But I think for the government, it's a question of is what was old new again in terms of super-specking offenses, given all the risks that can attach to those super-specs? And if so, how do you, for lack of a legal phrase, chunk them together? How do you put those offenses together that warrant a super-spec? How do you pull out those offenses that should be separate? Do you charge separately based on which sort of subsection of 128 Bravo you're operating under, for instance, a violent offense versus strangulation? Or are those all still 128 Bravos that need to be super-specced? What do intervening events look like?
Yeah.
How much time do you need in between offenses?
What does uninterrupted mean? Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I think that challenge is unfortunately one for the field right now to think through. And likely one, too, where some sense, if you're the government, of what matters and what are you willing to acknowledge as a specification that exists due to concerns about exigencies of proof that ultimately you would look to merge for a sentencing issue, that perhaps being more upfront and less opaque in your charging rationale may help the government through some of these questions by the defense, and rightfully, the defense should be challenging the government's charging theories on these cases unless and until guidance comes.
Right.
If we think we're going to see more IAC at the CAF or at the ACCA, I suspect trial courts may well see now a lot more 404B motions. If there are going to be fewer offenses listed on the charge sheet, but otherwise captured, or perhaps it's just captured as res gesta of the offense, depending on its timing. But that itself is a murky area of when does res gesta begin and end. But I think that is a likely consequence at the trial level.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think we're in the same, essentially we're in the same boat we were before with the Clark number of beatings as opposed to number of strikes test. I think to Major Fine's point, when it really matters is after jury findings, or if you are in the plea world before sentencing. I think our practice point has to be like take a very close look at what charges remain and whether or not they should be dismissed or merged. And I think if we do that, then we can avoid some of the multiplicity issues on the back end. And I think what the test announced after Malone is like we should be doing that.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for your thoughts and commentary on both Malone and a little shout out to Ford as well. We'll look forward to our next opportunity to address maybe these issues of waiver as well as the unit of prosecution and some pending cases still before the CAF. But thank you both for your time in this, and we hope all of you out in the field are able to take something positive away from this discussion.
Thanks, Major Fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.